Hey, I'm Erica from Carol Stream, and I'm 24 hours away from my first Chicago marathon, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above-ground audio magazine.
It's marathon weekend. Good luck to everyone participating in this year's Chicago Marathon downtown and into the neighborhoods. That's always a wonderful event and amazing that people can run 26.2 miles. My hat's off to you. Welcome to Outside the Loop. This is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 886. What we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty in the WGN radio studios today. And I am happy that you are here listening to this show. So, hey, here's some good news. Chicago has been named the best big city in the United States for the seventh year in a row. This is according to the Condé Nast Traveler's Magazine Reader's Choice Award. If you don't know what Condé Nast Traveler Magazine is, you're not alone. I definitely had to look it up. Apparently, it's a luxury and style magazine. So, look, that's a win. There was a time when I was younger when I might say something like, oh, this is just a corporate type award that's targeted toward the downtown area and the lakefront. And maybe that's true, but I guess I would ask my younger self, is that such a bad thing? I mean, we do have beautiful areas of this city, and even if they happen to be in the areas of the lakefront and downtown, we should still show off what we got, right? But to be fair, there are other areas of the city that are also fantastic that won't get the publicity in a luxury and style magazine. Of course, because I'm me, and if you've tuned into this program before, you know that I'll say the Chicago Neighborhood Tavern is a special place that people should visit. I mean, seriously, if you want a true flavor of the city and you're from out of town, go to one of those places and chat up the locals. You're bound to find someone who will give it to you like it is. Our neighborhood parks are a wonderful component to the city. Our libraries, local restaurants and cafes, you get the idea. There's a lot to celebrate here. Despite this, we have our share of problems, and we know this. The crime issue is one of those. I don't know what's going on with the CTA, except I do know that the CTA president barely has any oversight, gets paid a lot of money, and doesn't even ride the CTA. So there's that. My point is that both the good and the not so good can be true at once. We have a lot of issues to address, and that's why we have our local leaders as well as a network of grassroots organizations and everyday people who are working to make a difference. So when a win comes along, let's celebrate it. It's really easy to get caught up in the doom scrolling of our Twitter feeds, and that serves up nothing but the bad. Sometimes we need to celebrate the good. So today, let's celebrate some quality conversation on the show. We'll talk local music from a unique live act. We'll learn about an alternative method of school discipline in CPS and discuss involving youth in the push to build a sustainable community. You know, a wise prophet once said, you take the good, you take the bad, you take them both, and there you have the facts of life. The facts of life. We are lucky to be here. And since we're here, it's up to us to take care of our environment for future generations. Everyone has some skin in the game when it comes to environmental sustainability because this affects all of us. Seven Generations Ahead is a locally based nonprofit that works with local government, community, and private sector leaders to make changes to build a healthy and sustainable future. They've been doing this work since 2001, and Gary Kinnean is the founder and executive director of Seven Generations Ahead. Check them out online, sevengenerationsahead.org. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Nice to have you here. So this This is an interesting origin story here. As our kids, you know, we think about how they inspire us, and I think this is so cool. Your son, back when he was very young, he kind of inspired you to go down this path of working towards environmental sustainability. What happened here?
Well, it's interesting. I was doing some international organizational consulting work and, you know, getting all of these updates via email and on the news about all of these environmental catastrophes that were happening all over the world. And my son at the time was 4 years old. And I thought to myself, it kind of hit me like a rock. I thought, what if he were to get, you know, turn 40 at some point and ask me, Dad, did you see any of this mess coming environmentally? And if I didn't have a good answer to that question, you know, and what did you choose to do about it? And if I didn't have a good answer to that question, for some reason, it just kind of hit me over the head. So at that moment, I decided that I was going to do some research and figure out a way to create a local organization that was addressing global environmental issues.
And I think, you know, by the way, I love that story because our kids, my kids are 8 and 6. And, you know, you look at them and you think, yeah, you know, what responsibility do I have? Do we have to make sure that they have a place to live, that their environment is going to be healthy? And I think that's a big question. And your approach here of tackling these big environmental global issues, but you do this in a very locally focused way. Why did you choose to do this work in that particular way?
Well, actually, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's a combination of one, some of the preliminary research that I was doing gave me an insight onto what other organizations were doing in the space. And we didn't want to be duplicative and obviously wanted to respect the different strengths and scopes of work that other organizations were doing. I just felt like the key for us was to be able to reach mainstream institutions and to be able to effect change within them. You know, it's easy to reach the choir, right? Easy to preach to the choir. But the choir is a very, very small cross-section of people and institutions in the world. And so we wanted to be able to make inroads with school districts, municipal governments, park districts, libraries, businesses, faith-based congregations, that were in the mainstream and really do the, not only the education around why this is important, but then help to guide them through the steps that they could take to actually lead toward results to impact everything from the climate crisis to equity to other sustainability initiatives.
So you mentioned a few things there, and these are big issues. When we think about a sustainable community, specifically an environmentally sustainable community, what are we talking about there? What does that look like? What does that mean? Because I think we hear those words and they sound great and maybe we're on board and we want to be very aware of our environment and try to protect it. But what does it mean to be environmentally sustainable in a community?
Another great question. And, you know, first and foremost, the international scientists through the International Panel on Climate Change are telling us that we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 45% by 2030 from pre-industrial levels and by 100% by 2050. So that's sort of like the first marker. How do we reduce emissions as a community, as a region, as a country, as a world? Outside of, and that could be done in a variety of ways, through energy efficiency upgrades, through renewable energy. We're doing a lot of work in solar right now, and sometimes that could be on-site. Sometimes that could be just procuring energy from other initiatives. But when we look at the broader issue of sustainability, it also incorporates things like reducing waste and being able to take material out of landfill, particularly material that could be used for other purposes like food scraps, and convert them into composting. We look at water quality protection, and we look at water conservation. We look at transportation. You know, how do we create communities that are bikeable and walkable while reducing emissions? And green infrastructure. You know, we're in the Midwest. We're getting deluged like a lot of places with extreme weather events, rain events, and that creates flooding. And so how do we create a landscape and infrastructure that's going to be able to absorb that water, and so that we're not dealing with the flooding issues, and so that we're filling up our aquifers. Mm-hmm. And so there's a whole host of things that go into what makes a sustainable community.
Yeah, so just one or two things there that are important, of course, but we want to think about how you're doing this. I know you're getting into schools. I think this is really a very important aspect of what you do at Seven Generations Ahead. You have developed some programs that are in schools in Illinois, things like curriculum about gardening, teaching nutrition in elementary and middle schools, zero waste programs in schools. So really, we think about how do we become this community that is sustainable for the future? I mean, it really starts with some pretty ground level education, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've collectively as adult leaders, I would say, have failed in our quest here to pass on an earth that's going to be in better condition than we inherited it. And so we think it's really important to engage youth, whether it's educating them on a school-based level in elementary school about the importance of waste reduction and composting, or eating healthy, or sourcing local food, or at the higher levels, engaging them in processes that will, with adults, that would create sustainability policies for their high schools, or create other initiatives that are going to actually generate operational results within the schools. And so, you know, we need to build the next generation of leaders. Also, it's really important that children are educated about the opportunities in this new 21st century renewable energy economy. And if we're not teaching them about all of these things, they're going to miss opportunities moving forward. And so sort of passing the baton on to the next generation is a big part of what we try to do at Seven Generations Ahead.
And I know that you have been really instrumental in getting some local students, some local high school students, to go to the climate summit. And that continues this year.
Yeah, we're really excited. Some years ago, I submitted a proposal to the Oak Park River Forest Community Foundation as part of a big idea challenge. And the idea was to create a program that would build youth sustainability leadership and really teach them skills to advocate for climate solutions and their futures. One component of that, it was to be able to get our status as an observer organization at the UN Climate Summits. And so this will be our fourth year of taking a handful of students. This year we have six to the UN Climate Summit. This year it's in Dubai. And they get to participate along with the adults in all as many sessions as they're able to attend. There are negotiation sessions that happen. There are large scale keynotes. Our youth have been able to meet with Al Gore, with John Kerry. They've been able to see our President Biden and former President Barack Obama talk. So they're getting exposure to what's happening on an international level. And we just think it's we know that it's a life-changing experience for these youth, because they tell us, and it's just one component of a broader program that's really designed to build their capacity, educate them, and equip them to act on their behalf.
It's such a cool opportunity for these kids, and I'm glad that something like this exists. Gary, let me ask you here, in terms of how we're doing when it comes to environmental sustainability, I know that that's a hard question because it tends to be like a roller coaster. I feel like some days there's a lot of good news and other days, maybe not so much. So when you take a look here from, you know, a 30,000 foot vantage point, overall, are we making forward progress? Are things going in the right direction? Because it doesn't always feel like things are going in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, I'm both an optimist and a realist, and honestly, I think we're making incremental progress, but the window continues to close from a time frame standpoint on the changes that we need to be making in order to stay within that 1.5 degree Celsius increase that the scientists tell us we need to stay under. And so from that perspective, we are way behind, in my opinion. And we need leaders to be able to make some really significant, hard decisions about investing in this new economy that is going to be free of fossil fuels. And at the very least, we need to be doing this transitioning now on a large scale. And it's not happening at the level that it needs to be happening. And, you know, and I'm not just talking here locally, and I'm talking globally. There are a lot of issues that countries are facing, and many of them still need to be convinced and prodded that that this is something that they need to make a top priority, because it's literally going to impact every single aspect of their communities and their countries. These extreme weather events are horrific now, and they're just going to continue to get worse and more frequent. And we're at the point where there could be some really serious shifts in our global ecosystems that are going to make it really hard to recover from these changes. And we all hear about the ice caps melting and the deforestation and the burning of forests and all of these other things. So we're behind, and there's no way to sugarcoat that.
Well, I am optimistic because of organizations like Seven Generations Ahead and the work that you are doing at a local level. We can all check out the website, sevengenerationsahead.org. It's a wonderful local organization that works with community leaders, government leaders, and the community to make changes to build a healthy and sustainable future for the next generation and beyond. Gary Kinnean is the founder and executive director of Seven Generations Ahead. Hey, Gary, thank you so much for talking to us today, and keep doing this wonderful work.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks for your work on behalf of our youth.
One of the most difficult and most important parts of a school is classroom management. And with that issue of classroom management comes school discipline. Over the last 50 years, schools have used exclusionary discipline, such as suspensions, at a relatively frequent rate. And the rate of school suspensions more than doubles for Black and Latino students. An alternative to this kind of punishment is the use of restorative practices. There hasn't been much research done on restorative practices, that is, until now. Anjali Adukia is an assistant professor at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and Ben Fiegenberg is an associate professor of economics at UIC. They are the co-authors of a new report called From Retributive to Restorative, An Alternative Approach to Justice, and they are here with us today on Outside the Loop. Anjali and Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. So good to be here. Thanks for having us.
Wonderful to be here. We should just give a shout out to our third co-author, Fatima Momeni, also from University of Chicago.
That's right. We want to make sure everyone gets their just dues here. Let's talk about what this is here. So we're thinking about schools. We're thinking about discipline in schools. I said restorative practices. That is something that maybe A lot of us don't know what that is, but that's what you're researching here. So, Anjali, can you just give us some context here? When we say restorative practices in schools, what are we talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you said, classroom management and discipline represent one of the hardest jobs of a teacher. So despite knowing of the potential harms that might be associated with being in a stricter school, right? We see that, you know, being in a stricter school can lead to long-term harms such as reduced educational attainment or increased likelihood of engagement with the criminal legal system. You know, educators see themselves facing a trade-off. They say there has to be some response to what is perceived as undesirable behavior, particularly in a context where 80% of schools report having incidents of violence, theft, or other crimes. They say the alternative can't be do nothing. And so, you know, is it that you suspend students and potentially cause them harm, or do you keep disruptive students in the classroom and then potentially harm the learning of their classmates? How do you navigate this perceived trade-off? So in comes restorative justice. And what is restorative justice? It's a philosophy. It's more about repairing harm between victims and offenders or restoring relationships. And often it's really transforming relationships because they didn't exist in the first place. And so, you know, it's about really increasing perspective taking. And in schools, in particular, it's referred to as restorative practices because it can be, you know, it can range from a restorative circle, peace rooms, peer juries, you know. So for example, if, you know, a child writes on the walls, then you can imagine what would then manifest is that the child meets with the custodian. And in that meeting, the custodian says, well, this is how it made me feel. And do you know how this added to my workload? And now I had to be late to my kid's ball game because I was busy cleaning this up. And then the child says, gosh, you know, I didn't even think about this. This was just fun and games for me. And, you know, it's important to remember as well that, you know, sometimes people say, well, with these restorative practices, you're just letting kids get away with whatever. But if they don't represent the absence of consequences, but actually what they mean is the use of logical consequences, which are designed to address the particular harm that's been done in an effort to repair that harm. So, for example, in this case that, you know, I just mentioned in terms of, you know, when a child wrote on the walls, the logical consequence that we saw was they actually then shadowed the custodian for the day to see, okay, well, what is it that this person does? And I'm going to help them through the day.
Hmm. In terms of your study here, now that we kind of understand what restorative practices are, so Ben, I mean, you were looking in this report, you were looking at CPS because the district implemented these restorative practices. So in terms of on the whole here, what you found from your research, and let's dive into this. It's important to understand because the context here also is that we are seeing people of color incarcerated at a higher rate. We are seeing people in certain communities get arrested and go through the justice system at a higher rate. So that's another piece to this. In terms of what you found about the impact of restorative practices, what is that impact?
Sure. So, I mean, the effects of restorative practices that we identify in our research are quite striking, we think. You know, a quick summary. So we find roughly an 18% decline in out-of-school suspensions, a 19% decline in child arrests, including a 35% decline in arrests that take place on school grounds, a 15% decline in out-of-school arrests. You know, and this is across the board. So declines in arrests for violent, for nonviolent offenses. And what I think is important from an equity perspective, you noted that, you know, disadvantaged students, minority students, have traditionally been more exposed to, you know, punitive punishment within schools, to contact with the criminal justice system. And indeed, we find that Black students and Black males in particular experience the largest declines in out-of-school suspensions, in arrests, and correspondingly, we see some evidence of increased attendance above and beyond those suspension declines. And so I think one takeaway here is, you know, we're seeing a reduction in these disparities that are present at baseline. And then some evidence as measured by school climate scores, so student reports of their own perceptions of what it's like to be in their school and their sense of belonging and their sense of peers' behavior, that the days that students spend in school are better days.
The criticisms of restorative practices here, I mean, things that I've heard is that, well, this is a lack of accountability. Students aren't going to learn their lesson. Students are going to feel empowered to misbehave because there aren't real consequences here. What did you find, or does that come up in your research at all when we look at these criticisms? Because this is something that I hear fairly frequently in having conversations about restorative practices in schools. Is that something that came across your report?
Well, I think, you know, as Ben highlighted, one thing that's really amazing is that while we do see decreases in out-of-school suspensions, and so one concern could be, well, are the children who are no longer being suspended, if they were the ones who were perceived as being very disruptive before, is it now that they're in school and they're actually going to, you know, harm the learning of their classmates? And that is not something we see. We actually do not see any increased classroom disruption. And, you know, actually in the school climate survey measures, students actually say that they feel that their classmates behave better and that their teachers trust them and that school is safer. So, you know, this is evidence that it seems like something meaningful is going on, and that it is that we are not actually in this equilibrium where, you know, we are potentially harming the environment. If anything else, it does seem like things are improving.
The way that restorative practices are conducted, how staff are trained, the implementation of restorative practices, that I know is very important. And Ben, when we think about how, in this case, CPS is doing, I mean, they have these restorative practices, but again, it's on the district to actually do them and do them well so they are meaningful, so they have an impact. But is that kind of a variable when we think about restorative practices in schools?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think, you know, we speculate that one reason CPS was so successful in implementing restorative practices is that they really leaned on external expertise. And so, you know, the training among school staff in restorative practices, my sense was, probably wasn't sufficient for this to all be done internally. And so initially, when they decided to roll out this programming, they brought in, you know, leaders from a number of local organizations who have been working in this space for quite a while, and they intensively coached school staff, you know, to really try to transform the culture, but also to prepare school teachers, administrators, janitors, you know, everyone working in schools to be able to implement these same principles. Because there's a sense that, you know, this works best when everyone's on board, when there's buy-in, you know, at all levels of school operations and administration.
And one thing that's really nice is that this has helped to serve as ongoing professional development for teachers and support to learn how to implement the practices, because it's hard. You know, if on Monday you came in and said, oh, you know, I'm having this trouble with Anjali, and then, you know, the coach can say, well, let's role play, let's talk through that. And, you know, they come back on Wednesday and say, well, how's it going with Anjali? Well, actually, this is what happened, but actually I have this other issue where the cafeteria worker wants to talk with them, you know. And so then it was this opportunity when coaches were coming 2 to 3 days a week for an entire year to not only feel supported, but to also feel that you're constantly being able to develop as a professional and then learn from each other across, you know, the entire school staff.
Yeah, you know, I'm thinking about here again, context is so important. And when we talk about discipline and classroom management, and we have to talk about what students are bringing into the building from the outside. And obviously, when the bell rings at 3 o'clock or whenever school gets out, the students go to wherever they go. And some students go to areas that are maybe more conducive to homework and are more peaceful, and other students don't. That's just kind of how it is. So do we have to factor in any of what's going on outside of the school, outside of the classroom, when we think about what's happening in the building in relation to restorative practices?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a key innovation of restorative practices, understanding that people's behavior is born from their experience, and that, you know, having sort of a cookie cutter approach to saying you do something bad, you get suspended, or you do something really bad, you get expelled, you know, isn't going to address those root challenges. And I think, you know, in talking with CPS staff in the Office of Social Emotional Learning, who have really taken the lead in implementing RP moving forward, and, you know, over the last however many years, they really have come to the conclusion that it's important to get buy-in from students by introducing these practices, you know, before behavioral incidents arise. And so having students circle up and just talk about what's going on in their lives and what's going well and what's hard, and that, you know, instilling that buy-in early on can make it much more effective to use restorative practices, you know, when there are challenges that arise down the road.
Hmm. And it seems that, you know, a school really has to commit to this. And like what you've been saying, CPS seems to have really committed to this. But I feel like if there's a school or a school district that maybe kind of goes in and doesn't do this all the time, and then part of the time we're doing restorative practices, there could be some, in my mind, I think there could be some disconnect there, and the students might not know what's going on. Maybe students would think that they could get away with stuff. But I think we really have to be explicit in really communicating this to students in addition to the parents, because if the students don't know what's going on, well, then the whole thing is just going to blow up.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Absolutely. No, I think consistency is critical in this space, and making sure there's a clear understanding of, you know, what consequences are in response to actions. Because I think a key theme of restorative practices is that it's all about logical consequences. It's not about a lack of consequences.
Anjali, let me ask you this. The takeaway from what you've done here, this report called From Retributive to Restorative, an Alternative Approach to Justice. Maybe, you know, we're hearing this, some of us, and our heads are spinning because we don't, this is new, we don't quite get it, but that's okay. This is really, I don't want to call it a new way of thinking, maybe new-ish, but the way that it's being implemented on such a broad scale in many school districts is relatively new. When you look at your data here, what do you think is a big takeaway from this report, and what should we know going forward?
Look, restorative practices are not a panacea, but it's an opportunity for policymakers and practitioners to look at the promise of this work, for thinking about, you know, different ways of engaging with student behavior, both being proactive, as Ben was mentioning, you know, that in the, you know, in the mornings you come in and you do a restorative circle and you actually hear, wow, like, gosh, this student had a fire next door. This student had, you know, a parent get, you know, incarcerated. This student didn't have any food. And now, oh, this one didn't have their homework done. Instead of, gosh, immediately being frustrated and whatnot, I actually now see my students. I can now, you know, understand where everyone is coming from. And so we can move forward together as, you know, as human beings. And so I think that it is a model, and it's great to see how something that was not, you know, this is not something that researchers came in and said, hey, we're going to create some idealized laboratory setting and say that, you know, this is how you're going to implement it, this is how you're not going to implement it. This was done by the Office of Socio-Emotional Learning, and, you know, they scaled it up with all of the imperfections and difficulties that one actually has to face in terms of, you know, when you put these things in a practice setting. And so it gives us, you know, a glimmer of hope that, gee, there's ways that we can not only affect students' outcomes within school, but also outside of school. And, you know, for just thinking of alternative ways to, you know, deal with this this kind of paradigm that we found ourselves in of overly relying on exclusionary discipline, where we don't actually see the results that we want from exclusionary discipline. So it's worth trying something new.
Well, and I think you hit on the humanity aspect. That's something that we have to keep at the forefront here. We're talking about people. We're talking about human beings. We're talking about children. And, you know, this whole system, I think, is continuing to evolve. And sometimes we need to take a critical look at how we educate our students, not just academically, but as a whole person. This report is really fascinating, and it's called From Retributive to Restorative, an Alternative Approach to Justice. We will link up to it on our channels through OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com. Two of the authors of this report, Anjali Adukia, is an assistant professor at the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago, and Ben Fiegenberg, an associate professor of economics at UIC. Anjali and Ben, thank you for all of your hard work on this, and thanks for talking to us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, it was wonderful speaking with you.
Let's talk local music right now. How about the sounds of the group The Sideshow Villains? They have a new EP out right now called Claws for Breakfast, and they will be performing on Sunday, October 22nd. And not just music, but there will be aerial acrobatics as well. It's a whole cabaret. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll talk all about that with Dante Ingram, who is the band leader. She writes the songs. She sings the songs for Sideshow Villains. Check out SideshowVillains.com. Dante, welcome to Outside the Loop.
Thanks so much, Mike. It's good to be here.
Well, it's nice to have you here. So we'll talk about the music specifically here in a minute, but I said it's not only music when you're live, but there is this special acrobatic cabaret style performance that you do for your live show. Tell us about the experience of going to see Sideshow Villains.
Absolutely. So we have several aerialists and a dancer who studied Brutto. And we have sideshow performer Mark the Knife Fay, who's performed all over the world.
It's a great name.
And yes, I was his assistant for many years.
Ah. I
was his knife throwing assistant, actually. We toured together.
Wow.
And that's where I got my start performing, was touring with Mark, and then I started my first band fairly shortly thereafter. And so there's a special place in my heart for all things sideshow and cabaret. And when I was putting the EP together, my vision for live shows was always to have a variety of different types of performers involved and to showcase the performance as well as the music.
So the music, I think that's a good point, because the music does complement what you do live really well, because there is this kind of like jazzy, a little Americana in there, cabaret style. I mean, you listen to the tunes and it's like, oh yeah, kind of like a smoky, foggy stage. It's dark. There's a one spotlight going on. The band's playing. People are dancing and all kinds of stuff. That's really what I get out of it, how those feelings are brought forward. And that's really, as you're saying, what you're intending to do here.
Yeah, the songs are all stories, and each musical style is meant to complement the story that's being told.
And stories about, I mean, sometimes they're not pretty things like addiction and crime and things like that, but they're real stories.
Yes, yes, that's true. One of them was actually based on a real case here in Chicago.
Interesting. So we're getting a little, maybe a little history in there as well. When we go,
a little,
yeah, a little bit. Also, the entertainment value is big time, of course. So I think this is interesting that you have these aerial, these dancers that are, I mean, if you've never seen this, it's like people are suspended from pieces of fabric from the ceiling, and they're doing all kinds of just really fascinating and sometimes I think dangerous flips and twirls, and it's incredible to see, but that's what we're talking about here.
Yes, yes, exactly. The performers do trapeze, they do sling. Sling is like a big piece of fabric that's like a giant loop. I do silks, which are the two pieces of fabric, like big curtains that hang down from the ceiling. I'll be up there with Frank, my skeleton. He's about 5 feet tall, and we glow in blacklight.
That's amazing. And also, I have to think that can be a little treacherous because, yeah, you've got maybe black lights up there, but it sometimes gets dark when you're up that high.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's quite dark. It's, you always hope everything goes according to plan, and sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't.
That's right. Well, as long as you come out safe, everything's all good.
Absolutely.
That's right. The EP is called Claws for Breakfast. And again, this is, we have seven songs here, and these are stories. And again, that genre of a little jazz cabaret style. And it sounds, I think, really great.
Well, hello, pretty girl in the corner. Whatever are you doing with that guy? Come with me, open wide, now you're warmer.
Yeah, this is really unique, I think. This is pretty cool. So let's talk about the show on Sunday, October 22nd, 6 p.m. at Alhambra Palace. It's a place I've never actually been in. I've driven by it. I've walked by it. It is something that you cannot miss at 1240 West Randolph in Chicago in the West Loop neighborhood. It sticks out, and it's a cool-looking place. And this is, I mean, it's a restaurant, but they also have performances like this. So tell us about what's coming up 6 p.m. on Sunday, October 22nd.
So Alhambra is a dream venue. It is absolutely gorgeous inside. It looks like something out of a fairy tale. It is so beautiful. It's got huge ceilings, which of course we need because otherwise we can't do aerial. They're also used to having circus performers there, so that worked out well as well. The venue usually serves food, but during our performance, there won't be any dinner service just because we've got blackouts. So sure. People want to eat. They can always order food and have dinner prior to the show and just make a reservation. So that's easy enough. And the bar will be open so they can order drinks.
And this will be kind of like a celebration of this new EP. Again, it's called Claws for Breakfast. The show is Sunday, October 22nd, 6 p.m., Alhambra Palace Restaurant, 1240 West Randolph in Chicago, right in the heart of the West Loop, so really an area where everything is going on these days. But I think this is so cool what you're doing with the live performance and the acrobatics and making this a really, not just a musical experience, but really a multi sort of dimensional show. And I think that's a lot of fun for all of us. So we should all check out your website, sideshowvillains.com. We can get more information on that show on October 22nd. Dante Ingram is the band leader. She writes the songs. She sings for the Sideshow Villains. Hey, Dante, congrats on the new EP. Everything sounds great. And best of luck on October 22nd with that show.
Thank you so much, Mike.
There we go. Outside the Loop show number 886 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.